ever tried watching your athlete's game from anywhere in the world? With Replayer, you actually can. I had a friend watch his son's game live from his flight. My son watched a live game from the car while we were driving up the California coast. It doesn't matter where you are, grandparents across the country, cousins on the other side of the world, teammates who just moved away, set up the camera, hit go live, and everyone with a link is right there on the sideline. Live streaming is free. Unlimited games, unlimited teams, unlimited users. No complex tiers. Everyone gets access. And forget waiting hours for footage. I recorded a 60-minute game, and it was ready in 5 minutes. Players were clipping highlights on the ride home. One camera, made in the USA, unlimited everything. If you never want to miss those moments, head to replayer.com. The link is in the show notes. Hey soccer friends, I just want to give a shout out to our partner, TeamPlayer. They are changing the game on how you find the perfect soccer team for your player. Parents, this means no more endless social media scrolling to find information on teams. With TeamPlayer, everything you need to know is just a few clicks away. It's simple, straightforward, and lets you find the best coach and team for your player without any of the usual headaches. And coaches, we all know how tough it can be to get your team noticed, but when you subscribe to one of TeamPlayer's team plans, you instantly get access to set up an online team profile that allows you to reach more potential players and showcase what your team is all about. It's super easy and lets players and parents see why your team could be the right fit for them. And if you sign up using the promo code PITCH, you can try any team plan free for 1 month. So whether you're managing a team or searching for one, come on over to www.teamplayer.us. That is TeamPlayer.us. And come give TeamPlayer a look.
Family-owned Soccer Innovation is your go-to source for top-quality equipment. Whether you're a player, a supportive family member, or a dedicated coach, they have everything you need to elevate your game. For players, their innovative equipment are designed to boost your skills and performance on the pitch. From their agility cones to their portable goals, they have you covered. And family members, they offer durable equipment that's built to last because we know your support is critical to your player. Coaches, trust me, they can provide the equipment you need to run effective training sessions and shape the next generation of soccer players. Visit Soccer Innovations at soccerinnovations.com to start elevating your game with them.
And if you use the code PITCH, P-I-T-C-H, you can receive up to 10% off your next order. Hello and welcome to Chat by the Pitch. This is your host, Ian Babcock. As we get ready to head to the pitch for this conversation, listen to some of the key things they talk about. And one is the philosophy and culture here in the United States with the pay-to-play model. I think they're onto something with what they're saying and how they're trying to build and grow their club according to those philosophies they have from their countries that they're from. Listening to Wilco talk majority of this episode, with Dennis chiming in near the end due to technical difficulties on my end. Listen to what they have to say and try to understand where they're coming from, because their model that they're talking about can be successful here. Let's head to the pitch and start this chat.
Dutch Football Club, a club, our mission is to inspire a passion for the game by developing players to compete at the highest level. And within that mission is really three things that we focus our core values on, which is enjoyment, development, and competition. And it really stems from the Dutch methodology and philosophy of how the sport is cultivated there. So in Holland, there's only about 16 million people, and it's very much a community-based sport like it is in England and a lot of other soccer-developed countries. But what's unique about Holland is that if you go to Ajax, you go to the biggest clubs in Holland that are producing tons of professional players at the highest level, and they're selling for, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. But you go to all of these players, and you go to all of these clubs and these coaches, and the number one thing that they will tell you is you got to enjoy it. You have to enjoy it. It's just the game. And that very much stems from Johan Cruyff. You know, he also always talked about that. And, you know, it's very much about enjoying the game, developing to skill sets, developing the right understanding of the game, the intelligence side of the game, and then to try to compete. You know, a lot of clubs, they talk about developing, they never compete. And then there's other clubs, they talk about developing, but they don't actually develop. And all they worry about is competing, and they forget about enjoying the game. So in our methodology, we number one thing we try to establish is a passion for the game so kids don't burn out. We try to develop fundamental skill sets so that they can compete at the high school level, the college level, maybe even professional, maybe even on the national level.
So where are you guys located out of?
Yeah, so we're in Frisco, Texas. That's the only location we're at. We don't really plan on franchising. We've had requests to do so, but we're really kind of sticking with the methodology of being a community-based club, like it is in England, Holland, and most of the soccer-developed countries. You know, you see a lot of these youth clubs, they try to franchise, and part of the reason is because they charge $3,500 per player. It becomes a business. And I recently just came back from Holland, as well as England, actually, and club dues in Holland currently are $200 a year. And you can go in my hometown of 70,000 people and get on your bike and you can ride to 8 or 9 different local clubs. Each of them have about 2 to 3 teams within an age group. And that's the setup, right? And in the exit strategy in Holland is not college, which I think is a big hindrance to the American pyramid, I guess you can call it, right? The exit strategy is to try to get the youth players into the first team or sign on a contract where the club that developed the player gets a return on their investment of developing that player. They get a lot of local sponsors and they have other programs to help supplement the expenses of running a club. But a lot of clubs are, you know, volunteer-based clubs. They're not for-profit businesses. So we kind of wanted to model that philosophy and that ideology, I guess is a better terminology to call it, to be mostly a community-based club that services the community and that has 2, maybe 3 teams per age group. And we just want to be local and do a really good job of developing players within our immediate area.
Oh, that's something that is missing here. So now with that, how does that affect your fields, like fields then? I mean, it's kind of, I'm all bounced all over the place. I'm sorry. How does that affect like being able to have field space then? Because it's more locally over in Europe. I know there's a lot of field space to given to these teams and these clubs to go use.
So do you guys well, have actually, that's
facilities over there or
how does actually, that's actually not the case. So the way it works in Holland, as well as Germany and a lot of these other soccer developed countries, is that you have a club, they have 2 to 3, maybe 4 fields, and they organize a league, and then in that league, you play a home game and you play an away game. So you go to the other club and you play, and then the other club comes to your fields and they play there, right? And in Holland, which is kind of unique, they have a canteen where the parents can have a beer, the kids can have some Dutch French fries after the game, right? And there's a culture that's built around the club, right? Versus if you look, think about North Texas, where does everybody go to play games? They go to a facility that has 20 fields on them. They all show up 45 minutes before the game. They get to interact 10 minutes. You do a warm up. They play a game. You have a post game talk for 10 minutes and everybody goes home. There's no social aspect to it. You have to organize that outside of the soccer to actually get any team chemistry going, right? So a lot of the subtleties, relationships are missing in soccer in the US. And my parents experienced that when we took a trip to Europe. I mean, they were blown away with just this little club that plays in the third division in the amateur league, in Holland. That was my that's the club that my dad played for and that I played for growing up. And the experience was 10 times than what it was here in terms of the youth experience, right? We all went, we had about 50 people on the stands watching the game. It was loud. You know, we all walk out onto the field and it's like the kids feel like they're professionals, you know what I mean? And, you know, so that culture isn't here. And so, but these clubs, they only have two or three fields each. And that's the way we've set up. We've partnered with Stonebriar Community Church. We mission programming with them. We have three full-size fields. We're about to install lights. And we don't need more space than what we have. Now, if we're trying to franchise because we're trying to make as much money as we can, that's when you start seeing, you know, the FC DFW in Oklahoma. Right? Because, oh, we can make $3,500 from players in Oklahoma. That's fantastic. Let's open up another club over there. And then what these mega clubs do is they join these exclusive leagues that you have to be invited to, right? You have to be invited to these exclusive so-called elite leagues. And the only way that these other little clubs can get into it, they can't get invited themselves. They have to partner or merge with a mega club to be able to get in. Right. So you don't see that in a lot of these other developed soccer countries because it's not necessary. You know, you play in the league based upon merit, not based upon the size of the club. You know what I mean? And so it's an interesting differentiation. If you really look at the differences between how the soccer culture works here and in other places.
Right. Everything's always explained in dollars here in the States. Everything's a business here. It's not a community outreach. It's all about how to monetize something. And this is why relegation and promotion will never work in the States, is because I don't think an American owner has agreed to getting relegated and losing all that prime income and not having that desire to continue moving up.
Well, and the thing is that I'm not against business, right? So I'm an entrepreneur myself. But what I am in favor of is free market opportunity, right? So what starts to happen is with these mega clubs, they get so big that they start forming their own exclusive clubs that no one else can enter, even though they might be good enough. Because if they open it up to everybody, then they no longer have the uniqueness of that nobody else has access to. They have the scarcity benefit of being able to say, hey, you know what? You're a small club, but you have two really good teams, but you're not going to be able to get into this elite league. Why don't you join us and you can get into the elite league? So what starts to happen is it's a disadvantage for the soccer community because now families only have a few choices to join a few different clubs. Okay, now why is that a disadvantage? Well, where do you think your kid's going to get the most attention? On the 7th or 10th team in a mega club or in the first two teams of a small local club?
The more attention, the 1 and 2 teams. I mean,
100%, because the mega club in an age group will have 300 players trying out. And where do you think they're going to put their best coaches? On the top team, right? So how motivated is the 7th place team coach going to be when they develop a player? Because they know when they work really hard and develop a player, where's that player going to go? They're going to go up the food chain to the first or second team. So they always, the coaches down the chain always get the crumbs from the table and they have to start from scratch every time around. Well, that just takes all the wind out of your sails. And that's personally why I've never joined a mega club, even though I've been offered. And so has Dennis. I mean, Dennis is a UEFA licensed coach. He's one of the top coaches in the area. And, you know, I'll let you speak, Dennis, but that's why we've, you know, why we're working on building this club is because we get so much satisfaction from seeing a player go from, you know, being an average player to being a good player, to being a great player. but it takes us twice as much effort, twice sweat equity to do that versus the mega clubs who can pick, you know, have the pick of the litter and can pick an athlete over maybe another player that maybe needs more time to develop, is maybe a late bloomer. You know what I'm saying? So I always recommend to parents, go for the small club because you're going to get so much more for your money.
Right. I understand what you're saying with that. I mean, having both my kids play at two different styles of clubs, you do see the difference of all the coaches at my daughter's club knows everyone. And my only reason my son knows some of these coaches is because he's guest played with them. It's not because, and it's the difference between having five or six coaches versus 100 plus coaches in the size of the club. So there is a difference, and they do work with all the kids differently. I mean, I understand what you're saying, small versus large. Now, you're leveraging, as a parent, you're leveraging the more individual attention to the top, because you only have two teams, three teams per age group. You're leveraging that the individual attention they get will be much greater for their players because you'll actually be able to have time to work with them. I mean, and that's the global picture here, correct? You're getting at.
Yeah, I'll let Dennis jump in on this. You know, I mean, we have what's, maybe you can explain the squad system that we do, Dennis. We have what's called a squad system. At a young age, under the age of, I would say, 14, 15 years of age, the majority of players that dominate the game are the ones that are most aggressive, and they also have early physical development, the early physical development advantage, right? Kids like Lionel Messi that might not be that physically advanced at a young age, they kind of get overlooked. And in fact, Messi was playing on the second team, the developmental team for Barcelona, up until the age of, I think, 14, 15 years of age. And then Cruyff actually watched him play and was like, why is he not playing with the advanced team? And the coaches actually told him, well, you know, he's kind of small, you know, and Cruyff said, put him up there. He'll learn. And it'll actually be good for him to, he's got the skills to compete and he'll learn. Right. And so, so sometimes it is a benefit to be on the developmental team because a player might not be ready to play at a more competitive level. So we develop those players, and when they're ready to be part of the advanced team, then we move them up, and vice versa. If a player's falling behind, they're not getting as much game time or they're not competing, we drop them down to the developmental level, because you can really evaluate players at three levels. You can evaluate them as at the bottom of the pyramid is basically a developmental player. Okay. These are players that are, they don't have the technical ability compared to the rest of the group, and they just need a lot more time. And then in the middle section, they are called role players. These are players that can go in and play at least 50% of the time, and they'll do a decent job. And then you have impact players. Impact players are players that can change the game, right? They're going to prevent the goals. They're going to score the goals. They're going to give the assists. They're really significantly going to impact the game. So a developmental player on an advanced team might be better off playing as a role player on a developmental team, right? Or an impact player on the developmental team might be better off playing as a role player on the advanced team, right? So you kind of have to, the coaches have to work and coordinate together to be able to decide where these players fit best, right? And so We use what's called a squad system, where the two coaches decide where these players go based upon what's best for the player as well as for the team.
Okay, I'm following you. So you guys try to have at least two teams. So you guys have a developmental team and a team one, team two, ultimately. And that's for what age groups? You said 14 to 15, under U14, correct?
Yes.
You have this all the way through your system.
So our oldest age group is 2008, and that's the team we started with, and then the youngest age group is 2017.
All the way from 2008 to your 2017 team. So you guys have anywhere from maximum three teams per age group, but try to have two, so you can have the developmental side and the, I guess, more of the advanced squad playing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we call them developmental and advanced because we don't want to call it the first team and the second team because we don't treat players on the developmental team as second squad players. We know they're in the works, they're developing. I mean, you know, I didn't start playing soccer till I was 10. I was really late. I was a late bloomer. I was very small when I was young. And really when I turned 15, 16, I surpassed a lot of my teammates that were way further advanced than I was. So I was very often on the developmental team and I ended up playing on the, I was out of my entire age group, out of my class, I was the second player to join the top team, the first team in the club, which is, you know, you're playing with 30-year-olds and you're playing, you know, that's the top team, top of the pyramid, right? So, you know, I was the second player to join, and even though an LML team, you know, so it doesn't matter where you start. What matters is where you finish.
Right. It's trying to get every player there. I like the analogy of popcorn. You never know when the popcorn will pop for every player. Everyone, it's
different. That's right.
We use the terminology when the light comes on, the light bulb comes on. Right. You know, because you never know. You know, you just never know when our player is going to develop. And like you say, some kids are superstars at 8 and 9 years old, and then all of a sudden they've dwindled out of it by the time they're 12. You know, so, and then other kids, you can see the potential, and it can be a physical thing. It can be just a physical thing where they're not as big, they're not as athletic yet. Especially growing into your body is one of the key things as well. People actually don't actually pay a lot of attention to. You know, you see that child that's like a tall, gangly kid, and their legs are kind of all over the place as if they can't control them under their body. Well, that hinders a lot of players for at least a year or more until they grow into their body. And you can see that they have all the potential in the world, but they're just not able to, when they run, it looks like they're going to fall over when they're running. But it's just a natural process, but it's so frustrating for the player. But it's also frustrating for the parents because they kind of go, oh, what's wrong with them? When it really is just a matter of you just got to continue to be patient. They have to still do their work for, you know, to work on the athleticism to help them. But that is one part of that development that most players will grow through, that growth spurt. And it can be a good thing. If your body doesn't fit it, then it's a negative thing initially. But
yeah, I love that. I love that, Dennis.
But yeah, I mean, that's a valid point because you see these kids that haven't, you guys have talked about, haven't grown into who they are. As soon as they do, if everything else is there, it's like a click and they're going to take off running.
Yeah.
Good to hear that you guys are aware of that. Now, how do you guys approach parents with this? Because I know that here there's the constant, my kid's always the best or my kid's this top athlete. And when they get knocked down, and it's not because they're bad or not doing well, it's just that they need more touches in a different angle, so to speak. How do you approach the parents?
Well, I think it's important to have that communication, right? And one of the most important things is you got to have the two coaches on the same page, because if one coach is not promoting the other coach and vice versa and behind the coach's back, like, hey, don't go to his team. I mean, it's just not going to work, right? And that tends to kind of happen with some of the mega clubs because they're so busy, they got so many teams, they don't really have to work together. You know, if one kid leaves because they got upset because they didn't make the first or second or third team or whatever, you know, like, ah, whatever, we'll just take these kids. You know, they don't have to work as hard, you know?
Right.
So when you have limited resources, you kind of have to make the most of it. And that's kind of the benefit of a small club is we have to develop our players, you know? And I think our parents see that. They see that all of our coaches are working hard to try to develop the players to their maximum potential. And at the end of the day, that's the goal. The goal is not to, you know, if we – we really don't care about developing professional players, right? And that might sound counterintuitive, like, well, you know, that you're not going to attract the right people. But the thing is, you know, you've got some of these other clubs that they're promoting. Yeah, we'll get your kid a scholarship. Yeah, we'll make your kid a professional player. you know, and that's not our priority. We have players that I believe could eventually actually go professional. They can get scholarships. They can get full rides. I had a full ride in college. I was an All-American. I won the national championship. You know, I'm very, very competitive. But the biggest thing that I took away from my playing career were the life lessons that I'm applying to business today. You know, it's more important to be successful in life than it is to be successful in soccer. You know, and so now if you have the potential to play at the highest possible level, we're going to help you get there. But that has to be something that has to be an internal desire for the player, you know?
Right.
And
be the parents.
Yeah. And, you know, so, I mean, I see so often a lot of these kids that are playing, you know, formerly the DA that is now the MLS Next. I mean, I talked to a lot of those kids and a lot of them, they quit, you know, they quit when they were 17, 18 and, you know, they just decided, it's not for me anymore. It's, you know, so you have to prioritize the passion for the game. It can't all be about winning and results, which are important, but it has to be more than that, you know? And I think sometimes that's lost in the process. So we want to give our families a great experience. We want to develop that passion for the game. We want to develop them to their maximum potential as far as they want to make it, as far as they're capable of making it. We're going to help them maximize those skill sets and their intelligence of the game. And then we're going to try to compete at the highest level, whether that's winning State Cup, whatever, you know. We're not sandbagging anything, but we think that there's more important things to life than soccer.
Which is an accurate statement. I was recently told that even if you go to college, soccer may be your avenue to go get your degree, but what do you do when you hang up the boots at the end of the day and 28 and you've only played soccer and you've played at a lower level? You don't have a background now to go get a job, like a 9-to-5 job, so to speak. You don't have a degree to help you leverage that now to find that. And I thought that was a really good point, that soccer is not the end-all be-all, because the few that make it through to the highest level, it's a very small percentage. It's like 0.05 or 0.08%.
Well, you know, it's funny is we can actually almost guarantee a $15,000 scholarship for players that are in our club. And the reason is because this year we only charge 17. So our dues are about half of what everybody else's dues are. We charge this year $1,700 for the year for Select. Academy is comparable. It's about $110 a month, kind of like what everybody else's is.
That's really inexpensive. I mean, I just got the quote for my son. He has the option to go play Select. And coaches' fees were just over $2,700.
Yeah. This year we charge $1,700, which is about half of what everybody else charges. You know, if you count that up, that's about $1,700, $1,800 in savings each month. So if you start with us at the age of 11 and you save that money or invest that money, that's close to $15,000 that you can apply directly to a scholarship.
That's impressive. I mean, just to be able to do it at that fee, for coaching fee,
yeah,
is impressive. Now, how do you guys have sponsorships for league fees, or does that go back to the parents and to
the players? Yeah, I mean, we do sponsorships. We're just very effective with our volunteers. We've got some amazing volunteers. We do pay our coaches. And because we want the most important asset in our club are our coaches. So we want to make sure we take care of our coaches, that they have the environment that they want to coach in. We pay for all of their education. We're reinvesting some in the fields this year. So we want to give them the environment that they can recruit, attract, retain, and develop. Right. So that's, we invest a lot in that, but then our staff, our admin staff, we're just very effective with using good volume invested in the club and help us out as much as we can to save money. But, you know, I I recently heard that from one club, a growing club, they're offering coaches, they're basically buying coaches is what they're doing. So what they do is they say, hey, listen, you've got two really good teams. Why don't you come be a director with us and we'll pay you $90,000, right? Wow. And so they're basically them and giving them a title, and then they want them to go build another division for them, right? And it's like, the type of coaches we look for are coaches that are good. Yeah, so our club dues are $1,700. They might go up a little bit because we're looking to invest in lights. Our team fees are, basically based upon the team. They're usually $500-$600, and that pays for team expenses, right? So like tournaments and a team canopy and your team flag or stuff like that, right? Then you have uniform costs. Our uniform costs are about $350, I believe. And it's a pretty nice, they're pretty nice kitted out. A lot of clubs, they make money on the uniforms, So they're like $400, $450, they make, I mean, if you think about it, if a club makes $50 per player on uniforms and you've got 18 players, that's another, $800 to $1,000 or whatever that's coming in. So it's a big money deal for a lot of clubs. And, we're not against making money, but, we're doing really well with $1,700 a month per player. And we're able to pay for all of our field maintenance. We're able to install lights. We're able to pay our coaches really well. And the way we actually pay our coaches, we give them a portion of every player's dues. So it's a per player. It's mostly, we kind of treat it like a commission, right? So, if they recruit a player, I mean, we do a lot of marketing on our end, and we generate a lot of business for our players, for our coaches and teams. We bring them a lot of players, but we want the coaches to, instead of giving them a salary, we want them to be invested in the growth of the team, right? So we actually we reward them and incentivize them by paying them per player. We treat them like partners instead of employees. It's a little bit of a different approach. And, like I said, a lot of clubs, they're offering big money when I ran my previous club, there were some pretty big numbers being thrown around, and I was like, this just doesn't seem right. It just seems like the focus. And this is what I see a lot of times as well, is you get a dad or so far it's mostly been dads, they're coaching their kid, they have their kid in one of these mega clubs. They get upset with the mega club and they decide, I'm going to go start my own club and we're going to do it different. And then guess what? They turn it into a business and they start doing the exact same thing. They're no different than the mega clubs. They start franchising, trying to be part of these elite leagues, And, these elite leagues claim that, because it's some level higher than everybody else because we travel. Well, every Oklahoma team that I've played is always like, my team will be like Classic 2, Classic 3. To play Oklahoma, we'll play like the top two teams or whatever. And we'll like tie them or beat them 2-1, or we'll lose 2-1. You know what I mean? And these are like the ECNL teams of Oklahoma or Houston or some of these other, like these other states are nowhere near the competition level of Dallas-Fort Worth. So what they're doing is they're claiming that this exclusive league, because they travel, is at a higher competition level. And really what we're doing is we're doing a favor to these other locations, because we're coming to them and bringing them the best competition of Dallas.
Right.
And now Dallas-Fort Worth, and Dennis, I'd love for you to chime in on this. Dallas-Fort Worth is about the size of London. Okay. Dallas-Fort Worth has 6 million people. London, how many people in London, Dennis? 8 million. About 8 million. And how many EPL teams in London? I think there's what?
Chelsea, Fulham.
8, 9. That's just EPL.
Yeah.
Okay. And then you have how many championships teams in London? Probably another 5 or 6, yeah. Right? So there is so much soccer in London. And then everybody always says, well, that's London, right? That's England. They have a soccer culture there. Okay, hold on a second. What came first? The soccer culture and then the teams, or the diversity of teams and then the culture? I like to argue that first it was the diversity and lots of choices for people to join a club, right? And then the culture was developed, and then then all the EPL teams were developed from there. And so if you look at the American infrastructure, and MLS is a closed league system.
Yes.
You cannot join the MLS by winning something. It's not merit-based. It's purely status-based. Right?
But that is the big difference in America and their system anyway. The reality is it's status and it's financial. Sadly, that is the truth of the matter. And it, like you say, we know it's just grown phenomenal since. And the reality of it in England and around Europe and other parts and the other countries, what happens is you have the youth organizations, or they have the kid on the street first and foremost. You have the kid on the street and there's playing everywhere. That's pretty much what they do with basketball here. Once they start playing with their local club, which costs them virtually nothing to play for, they may have to pay for the referee, or they may have to pay for some subs or whatever to be able to get some snacks. Once they do that, what happens is every weekend there are scouts from the professional clubs coming out to watch those little local clubs. From there, they then come up to the coach and say, hey, I like that player or those players. I'd like to invite them into our club to come and train. And then in the end, what ends up happening is that they become a part of that professional club's academy, which is what they're kind of trying to say they have here, academy this and, you know, ECNL and all those kind of things, which is not the truth, because the reality is the difference with the academies around the world compared to how they would be here in America, and I think you mentioned it earlier, is that they could never, sadly, they could never, and I think Wilco was saying too about development and are you really about development? If you're really about development and in these academies, the results don't matter.
Right.
The results don't matter. Their focus is, for example, their focus will be on, okay, we've been working on passing for this school term, for example. And it's different variations on that passing. It could be a simple passing, progressing into 2v1 passing and connections and patterns of play. And then when it comes to the games at the weekend, they'll say to you, or could they call you and they say, hey, how did the team do? And they want to know, how did the team do in the execution of the things that we've been working on? Which goes back to almost what you were saying in the very beginning, Ian, about when a coach does his coaching. So they want you to have that input. How did they do with that passing that we've been working on? Now, don't get me wrong. You know, I, which had my son playing for them, we went 3 years unbeaten. Because you do have to instill, I mean, Wilco talks about it as part of the Dutch philosophy as well as what we operate on, is you have to have competition. So it's not a fluffy thing of saying, hey, we don't care about the results. But they're not leaving you if they lose 3 or 4 games.
Right. You can be competitive and still lose a game.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so, but I think a lot of the things here, it is, you know, oh, we didn't win, so we're leaving because that team's winning. And so we're going to go there because that's better. But then, and you see it even at the professional levels that, you know, players then leave because they think it's better, it's bigger and it's brighter. But then what happens is, if it doesn't work out, they just start to shrink and they just get lost at all levels of the game, sadly. That happens. And that is where the work that you do with the parents is really, really important, because you've got to be straight with them. You've got to be honest. You've got to tell them exactly how it is. And then if they believe in what it is you're offering, then you can end up developing players over a period of, like, the goal should be that your success of your club should be a goal that, okay, we've had this kid from 6 years old all the way through till they graduated the program. That is a success, when people want to measure success, that itself is success. Mm-hmm. Now, what if that kid didn't win a state championship or didn't play in ECNL? No, that's not the success. The success is that you actually kept those families within your club loving the game, enjoying it to the point of they graduated playing soccer through the youth levels. And that is the ultimate goal. That is the ultimate goal at the end of the day, because the professional goal is few and far between. People make it very few. You can say the people now, they've got all these leagues, ECNL, MPL, WSPL. They've got all these leagues out there. And let's not forget, a lot of those leagues have failed and they've just changed the name.
Yeah.
They've just changed the letters that they've added to it, sadly, because they're just searching for something that is, again, it's an elitist thing. And so in the end, it fails, because in the end, most true ballers, sadly, in this country, do not come from that elitist background. They're just kids that are out there playing and learning the game without being coached and having to pay $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 to play the game, being told what to do. They're just natural players. And so, you know, I think until...
Well, and if you don't mind me tagging onto that, Dennis, you know, and expanding on that, is that ultimately, how did the U.S. do in the World Cup? Well, they did well comparative to many in the years past. But if you compare the United States as a whole for 360 million people in the U.S., something like that. I mean, Holland has 16 million, you know? I mean, so Texas alone should be able to field a national team. And that's the way we should treat every state, in my opinion, in the United States. It's not, you know, it's the United States, you know? Just like Europe. Could you imagine if Europe put a national team together for the EU? It's going to be the EU versus the United States. I mean... it would be ridiculous. Like just Belgium. I mean, Belgium used to be part of the Netherlands. Could you imagine the Dutch and Belgium together with the national team would probably be world champions. Right. And so Belgium is like the Texas. Okay. And Holland is like the equivalent of DFW. Literally the size of DFW is about the size. I mean, it's a little bit smaller than Holland, but so the mentality is, you know, of the U.S. is they want to centralize everything. They want to control everything. But to develop a soccer culture, you've got to do the exact opposite. You've got to let go. You've got to have, in Dallas-Fort Worth, we should have 200 clubs, little clubs. But you cannot have that when you have Big Red and Big Blue, and they've got 500 teams. And they've got a division in every town. Like they got one in Plano, they got one in Frisco, they got one in Fort Worth, they got one in Irving. Like they just and they leverage their and their power to monopolize, and that's not good for the local soccer development of culture.
Well, that system only really works, like I said, for the minority, because it's very few of those players that stick with it. Because we're talking about only the top two teams.
Yeah.
So system works for if they carry a roster, for example, of 22. That's another situation in this country that I don't understand. So they want to carry a roster of 22. Well, now you imagine if you have three teams carrying rosters of 22, that's 66 players and only 33 are playing. There's another three teams for another club.
Yeah.
And when you break it down in that concept, you know, and then the system here, you know, if they did a true scouting system, that meant every single child that played the game in this country or was out playing on the street somewhere or on a park somewhere, if they had a true scouting system, a proper one, that was open to all players, not just because you played in the ECNL and you can afford to play in those areas, because that's the only time they really scout those kids. So many street kids would be given the opportunity. And there's so many street kids that are way better just because they play from a natural feel, not from what they're being told
to
do. Right. And that's how the national team gets better. Is you open the door to all players. You open the door to all players, the male, the females, if they're out there playing, because if I'm not mistaken, Mia Hamm, she got picked up by, basically, she was playing in some park.
Yeah.
And somebody came by, saw her playing, and was like, hey, we need to get you into this program.
Yeah.
But I've been a part of those programs and coached in those programs, and it is very restrictive. It's a very closed door group. It really is. It's like, I remember working for the region four, and we were picking players for the regional team and for the national group. And when I was doing the camp, at the evening, we would do debrief and pick players. And then they were saying, well, oh no, we can't pick them because there's these three players. They're not at the camp, but they played last year. And I'm like, well, these three players are here and they performed to that level. And they basically bent that. Okay, so those three that played last year, they're in the system. So they stay. They're in the system. So they stay. And that is what goes on, especially when you look at Cal South and Cal North. It's a real closed door, sadly, for a lot of players. And I talk about it because I know I have my son played for England in two World Cups and played in the Premier League. So when people talk to me about soccer and what he was doing there, and we weren't a rich family, he got picked up at 7 years old and went to Nottingham Forest to start. And then the program, the academy, developed and developed and developed and developed and just focused on the development regardless of the results, even though we won for 3 years. And they stuck it, and they stuck it. And then he went on, and which a lot of those players do. Also, a lot of them fail, don't get me wrong. But a lot of them get that opportunity without having to pay up front.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and they're very honest with you. They're not fluffy. They're basically telling you, hey, this is what needs to happen if he wants to get to the next level. And that's how I look at my coaching as a person. It's like, I've seen it to the level of, because I know you mentioned early on about coaches and if you've played the game and those kind of things. There is something to know what you're talking about because you've done it, or you've seen it, or you've developed somebody into that. So, for example, if someone says to me, hey, I'm really interested in my child playing college ball, what does that entail? Well, I can actually read a book and tell them what it entails, or I can listen to somebody on another podcast about college and recruiting and all that and tell them what it is. But I can also tell them this is what it really is, because I've lived that life also here with my daughter that went on to play Division One. So there is some value to having that experience and living it, because now when you're talking to somebody, I feel as though when I'm talking to them, I'm actually talking to them from a very true and clear, concise point of soccer. Not even bringing up my own playing, but this is what it is. And usually people respect that a lot more if you come at them with the truth as to exactly where they stand. And it doesn't have to always be ECNL. Success can just be you continue to play this game for 8 years and you've loved it. That is like playing ECNL. We'll take it.
Well, and you know, how do you decrease the cost of club soccer? You increase the supply of clubs.
Yeah.
If you have more competition for families to choose from different clubs, it decreases the cost. And it increases the quality of the experience. You know, so the more small clubs that exist, the lower the cost is going to be for everybody and the higher level of service that the players are going to get. And that's what you get in Brazil, South America, Europe, in all soccer developed countries except America. So, you know, and then I hear all the time people counter that and say, well, you know, we're not in Europe. Well, maybe we should look at what's successful there and what's successful in South America and other soccer developed countries, and not be so stubborn in saying, you know, because I mean, what if they just try to, create the Super League in Europe, right? I don't know if you know about that, Ian, but what they try to do is they try to get all the top clubs in England. I mean, England was basically, that's where Soccer Haven is, the best league in the world. It's just the way it is. And they try to get the top clubs from Italy, two clubs from there, you know, Real Madrid. And they try to make an exclusive league so they can capture all the money
Yeah.
And what is, why did it get, why did it fail? Because the UEFA and FIFA said it's going to kill the culture in soccer. So if FIFA and UEFA and Europe are saying that closed league systems kill culture, then we're already dead in the US. We don't have soccer culture in the US. You know, we don't. And it's just the way it is. We do not have a soccer culture. We do not have a soccer developing culture. We are just pretending.
I think you said it right there. It's the soccer developing culture. It is, and this is the thing I've seen with a lot of clubs here, watching coaches pick, it's that they flat out said, I can go cherry pick the best teams because I have a name and I'm going to go build my team around my reputation that I've built in the past, so I don't have to develop players anymore. And it's really sad seeing that, because as soon as the next talented kid comes along, whoever's struggling on his team is now gone and that player now replaces him. And that's not, it's soul crushing for a kid, first of all. And then as an adult, as a parent, it's like, how can you, when is your turn? When is it, as a parent watching your kid getting their soul sucked away, watching them being removed from the team because their coaches are cherry picking their team players?
Well, you know, Adam, just again, that something in that, what you're saying also, you know, you've got to also, we're talking about clubs and how you choose clubs and all those things. And a lot of parents don't actually really put as much thought into choosing a club. For a sport, let's just say a sport, but we're going to talk about soccer, so they don't think much thought into how they basically would choose a club. Most of them actually will just sit there and go, I'm not being funny about this, a lot of them go, oh, that's the top club. That's the top club. And so I want my child to be a part of that top club. And the first thing they think about is they can afford to be part of that top club. They can afford to pay. They don't blink at paying $5,000-$6,000 for a year of soccer. So that's the first thing they think. Now, whether that's the best thing for their child, sadly, there are people that just think, I don't. They just want to be able to say, and my child plays for this club because it's the top known club, and they wear this gear, and then they start wearing that gear. And guess what? As Wilco said earlier on, which team are they on? Yeah. They're on the sixth team in that club. Which is sad, you know, like Wilco said. Now, if we take out that sixth team and they become 4 and 5 and it's in another club, and then the other two become 3 and 6 in another club, we now have 3 clubs and you have 6 options. And this is, parents do make these decisions, because I've seen it so many times that they don't, they will do the work. They won't just send their child to any school, whether it's a district thing or not. They won't just send a child to any school. And they have expectations of a teacher when they're in that school. They don't want that child to be sat in the back of the class and the top students are being taught and given that information. But they're willing to accept it, strangely enough. If their kid sat on that bench and they're wearing that jersey, they'll accept it. So to some degree, there's an educating parents is also a big part of how we can create change to making decisions for kids that are not just short-term decisions. They can become more longer-term rather than short-term because you didn't really look into it.
Yeah.
Right. And I think I look at this as a parent now, and I look at my son. He's 9. He's playing a year up. He's a 2014 that plays on a 2013 team. As a parent, it's like, do we go back to his age group or do we let him continue until he's not progressing anymore, then put him back in his age group and hopefully he continues progressing in his age group? And I know that's kind of a, I don't know if it's a weird mentality or an odd mentality, but I look at my child and my child only. I don't care about any other kid on that team. I care about what the coach is doing and I care about how my kid's progressing. And then yeah. As I take a step back, looking at from when he started that team to where he is now, is the team progressing as a whole or is it stagnant? And this is the thing as a parent that my wife and I talk very heavily about. And is the team developing? And because we can do all the stuff on the outside to develop our kid, but if the team's not developing and they're staying stagnant, what would you tell the parents then? Because this is how I feel like you get to that point. Either the team's out developing your player or the player's out developing the team, and there's no way of, I don't know how to put it, pushing them to being a better player.
The development of players, if you're developing the players and the team should follow. Because individually, if you develop, if I'm developing you individually, and I have 10 players that have developed individually and they all start steadily improving, then overall, that's the collective. So that should then be reflecting on the field.
Yeah.
But you've also got to look at it in another perspective too and go, where are they? How many kids are they playing up? Are those kids playing up? Are they playing all the time? Or are they coming off the bench playing up? Should they go back to their age group sometimes to play to get some success? There's a lot of those things that you have to take into account. And then you also have to look at it and say, again, like I said before, has the light come on for them yet? Right. Has the light come on? You see, because when we say they're developing, what are you measuring that by? Is it by the results? Or are they suddenly going backwards and losing to teams and not performing well to teams that they were beating earlier? Now, are those teams that they're losing to now, are they really more, is it because of the physicality of those teams? Is that why they're losing? Or is it because now those teams are actually technically better than them and it's showing itself? If you start to go back, if you start to regress technically, that's a real problem. But there's not much you can do about the physical aspect. But if you're regressing technically and tactically, being aware, then that is a definite non-development.
Well, and the thing is that a player's development is dependent on the team's performance, right? So, but if a lot of times it's difficult, it can take 2-3 years to build a team and get them to play a certain style of play. Mm-hmm. Especially if you're playing out of the back, you know, if you're teaching your team to build up, as well as be able to go deep, you know, I mean, I like the Liverpool style where they can build, but they can also go direct. They can do both, you know. But the thing is that in a smaller club, you have a much better chance of developing a team and a style of play. Because the team tends to stick together a longer period of time. At least that's been my experience. At a lot of the bigger clubs, if you're really good at developing players and at developing a team, those players are going to get picked off. And if you're not the coach on the top team, well, there goes your team. I mean, literally, you could lose 5-6 players, good players, in one go. And now you got to start from scratch. So now, where are you? You got to start from scratch and spend your team. You see, so it's counterintuitive. When you're at a club and there's only two teams, usually you get a similar style of play between those two teams. But what I've seen at the mega clubs that and 15 teams per age group, there is no playing style. They say there's a playing style, but there's no playing style. The coaches do what they want. And that's totally cool, right? But the reality is that, you know, they're trying to compete with the other mega clubs and trying to be the first place in ECNL, State Cup champions or whatever, and they got to win because that's kind of what they've led with. You know, it's about the result. It's not about the performance. It's not about being competitive. You know, so... So yeah, I don't know. I just thought I'd throw that point in there as well.
So since you guys are a smaller club, so do you guys get together and come up with like a game plan for your coaches to work through for the season? Like if we're at this age group, or is it the whole club? We're going to spend the next 3 weeks on the next month, loading how to being more efficient with our passes, or we're going to work on X, Y, and Z in this time frame. Is it throughout the whole club, or is it broken down by age group then?
Well, again, you know, a lot of clubs will post and say that they have, this is our curriculum, or this is what we want to do. And I always try and tell people, I actually did an interview years ago and somebody asked me, what kind of a curriculum would you create for our club? You know, including systems of play and stuff like that. At club level, it's really difficult to say you're going to have a curriculum. Now, I think there's some key things. you know, your skill, your attitude to working hard in tactical or in tactical development and all those kind of things, technical ability. But then if I'm playing, my favorite style of play is a 3-5-2. That's me. That is my favorite style of playing. But my team, to play a 3-5-2, I need to have three athletes and beasts in the back straight away. Now, do I have those three athletes and beasts in every age group? And if I don't, then I've got to now think about, do I stick with my philosophy and my way, what I want the club to be for everybody? But then that's a detriment to that team. So with that said, yes, we want our kids to play a certain way. There's no question about it. But there's also, you've got to be realistic. And we see it even in the professional game, where some people are there trying to play across the 6-yard box. And you're going, why are you doing that? Because just because everybody else doesn't mean you can do it. If you have to knock it, you have to knock it. So there's also, we're open-minded in terms of how each of our teams is growing. And we give a lot of leeway to our coaches in terms of how they develop their teams. But yes, the ultimate thing is that we want them to play well. It's not about, like I said, yes, we love everything. I get this wrong. We want to win.
But well,
you can win and play poorly.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we don't tell coaches what exercises to do. We don't tell them the formation they need to play. I mean, shoot, the Dutch played a 3-5-2 in the World Cup, you know, and it's very un-Dutch of them to do that. But it made sense, quite honestly. I agree with the formation based upon having Van Dijk and De Ligt and Ake in the back. I mean, they're three amazing defenders, which is unusual for the Dutch national team. And we didn't really have a target player. We didn't have a center forward that the Dutch usually have. You know, like Van Persie or, you know, someone like that. But you can, but I agree. I mean, I play different formations with different teams. I think mostly what we try to preach and promote is an attacking style of soccer that's possessive oriented, right? And we do try to teach coaches and the teams to try to play a combination of, hey, try to build up out of the back because there's a benefit to being able to do so instead of just kicking it long every time. But you have to be able to play a deep ball, because if you never play a deep ball, the other team just suffocates you with pressure. And out of the defensive third of the field, when you have nine opponents in it, right? So you have intelligence to be able to say, oh, you're overcommitted? Okay, I'm going to get behind you then. And that makes them think twice about oppressing and overcommitting the next time. Now you have more space to build up again. You know, so methodology. I'm a big fan of the Liverpool style of play. I love it. And he's German. He's not Dutch, but so we try to promote, hey, try to play a possessive attacking style of soccer. And there are games where, you know, you have to I love this quote from Johan Cruyff, right? So he says, you need both quality and results. Results without quality is boring. Quality without results is meaningless.
Yeah.
Right? So there are games where I try to win. I'm not worried about playing good soccer. And I'm playing direct and I'm playing high press. And this is a game that we try to win. And then there are games where, you know, the result might not be that important. We try to build up a little bit more. We try to play some different styles, you know. So I think it all depends. But
when you listen to Wilco, right, and what he's saying about that and Liverpool and the way they will knock it sometimes, well, we have a laugh in the club because I'm a massive Man City fan with Pep Guardiola, which again, not English, not Dutch, but with Pep. And I'll watch Man City sometimes and they drive me crazy. Because I'm going, knock it.
Yeah.
Arlen's 1v1 up front. Play that ball in.
Well, when the Dutch played the Argentinians, I mean, yeah, we freaking tied it up in overtime, right before overtime. I mean, yeah, what was it? We were losing 2-0. We tie up 2-2. And I'm like, this is awesome. We got all the momentum. Let's keep doing what we're doing. And what do? In overtime, they go back to building up the damn game. I'm like, what are you doing? Go for the result. You know? So it's like, yeah.
You've got to be flexible. That's what it comes down to.
That's right.
So you guys coach to the players you have and try to build them individually as a team and as players because of the resources you have. I'm just glad to hear that. As a parent, that's what you like to hear. And I always ask when my son interviews or goes tryouts for a team, my first question I always ask is, and I find it kind of comical because they always take it the wrong way. I ask because it's creativity. My son at the age of seven spent a whole week, 2 hours every day working on how to perfect his rainbow because a coach challenged him to do it. That was within the club. He goes, if you can do a rainbow, I'll get you a signed ball of whatever player you can think of that I have reached to. And he goes, okay. And my son went and spent 2 hours every single day. And he looks to me during the game because I was coaching at the time. And he goes, can I do it whenever? I go, yes, we're up. I'm not worried. Do it. Just don't do it in front of the goal. And he goes and does it. And the rest of the summer, all the kids on the team tried to master their rainbow because Landon went ahead and did it. And that was because our coach encouraged him. And this is why I always ask the coach, I go, what is your take on a kid doing a rainbow during a game? And they said, no, I don't want a kid doing it. I want them doing exactly what I want them to be doing on the field. And it's like, I automatically tune out. And it's because they have to do it at the right moment, at the right time. It's not dealing, I don't want to stifle his creativity or him willing to try something new. A rainbow is an extreme case, but trying something new during a game, I think is imperative for his growth. And if a coach just knocks down any form of creativity, I get scared as a parent because I feel like you lose that whole aspect of the game. And I'm like what you guys are saying. Like, you guys are willing to foster the relationship with the players and from the sounds of it, and to build the player and the team up together as one.
On another note, level similar to that, right? I'm not bugging my son, and I'm proud of him to the maximum because he's retired now, but, you know, and his name is Jermaine Genius. And so when he started playing at Foresters in the academy, he was a striker. And as a young kid, he scored goals for fun. And I knew he was a natural because the way he was finished, I was just like, this kid's a natural. He just passed it into the corners. He bent it. He was just doing that at 6, 7, and 8 years old. He got to about 11 years old in the academy, and I was coaching that team. And I said to him, hey, I'm going to move you back into midfield. He's like, no, what's that? What's wrong? Why? I said, because I'm looking at some of these kids now, and they're getting big. These defenders are getting big. They're knocking you off the ball a bit. You're not having the same success. But guess what? If you're facing them, and you have the vision anyway, so because you can pass the ball, you've got great vision. If you're facing them, you're going at them, you should still score your goals. You should still get your fair quota of goals. I said, on the other side of that is, you're going to have to work harder. So guess what? It's going to make you fitter and stronger and better. So it's going to benefit you all the way anyway. Well, he moaned and didn't want to do it, and he was moaning and moaning. Well, he ended up playing. He had no choice, centre mid. Well, he ended up playing his whole career for England and for Tottenham and for Newcastle as a centre midfield player and scoring goals. So sometimes you have to be, again, being flexible to seeing the changes or that's what's going to benefit that child. And again, it goes back to that size thing. Why banging your head against that door when you can move them out of that situation to have more success?
Right. I think that's what's, as parents, that's very hard to accept. Like my kid's a striker. That's the only position he plays. I see it. I mean, my son plays wherever you tell him to go play. If it's center back, he goes play center back. If it's left wing, it's left wing. If it's center mid, it's center mid. It's like he just wants to play the game. He doesn't care. Then you see the opposite side of that. My kid only plays striker. And it's like, why? He's only 9 or he's only 10 or 7. It's like, let them experience everything. You never know what might click with them all of a sudden. It's amazing. I mean, I think I'm more open now than I was before with this stuff. But going along the same idea of players and everything.
And I think it's important for you to also realize that, you know, we don't have all the answers with Dutch FC. We don't have all the answers, and it may not be always what everybody wants to hear. But what we do know for sure is that we are about quality for the kids at a very competitive price, low cost compared to other clubs, but you're getting quality. This is what the difference is. You're getting that quality within our smaller club that's about the community, and we're working a few fields. Everybody comes together and we see the fields packed in the evenings, and most of the families know each other. That's what we provide. We're not trying to do anything with anybody else. What you see is what you get from us. So if that's what you're about, and we have coaches, Wilco, myself, we've played at the highest level, we've coached kids to the highest level. So we have it here, and they can actually come and be a part of that if that's what they're about. We'd love to have them.
So that brings me to my next question. So you guys, I understand where you guys stand on developing players and the Alphabet Soup Leagues. Do you guys have connections outside with colleges or with other teams? Like, I've talked to teams that have connections with in Mexico, to teams that have connections with, I'm drawing a blank on it, League One here in the States. Just a way to push the players or give them avenues to, when they come in, like, here's how we can help you achieve your goals, or is it your main goal is to get them to be seen and they provide it, if that makes sense?
No, I mean, at the end of the day, it's I was the head coach of the Vaqueros here, which is the MPSL team.
Yes.
Okay. We have the Dallas team send us, FC Dallas send us, and other clubs invites to their games. That's a big thing as well that people have used over the years and say, hey, we have a connection in college Division One. Oh, I don't know this person here and there. I've taken kids to England to have trials. You know, we have people that have been on trials in England. Wilco just took a team to Holland and got connections in Holland. So the connections is, if players want that opportunity, it's important to make sure you're doing it right, because there are a lot of clubs out there that just take those kids.
Right.
They just take them and say, look, come and train with us for 3 weeks. It'll cost you this. And they have no real interest in taking that child or that young kid. They just want to take the money, because a lot of clubs are linked. There are a lot of these big clubs that are linked to these professional clubs abroad, and you've got to be truthful about it. Who are you sending and why? If it's for the experience, fine. But when they start selling it and saying, hey, if you go to Atletico Madrid's camp here, you have a great chance that they will pick you up. Oh, if you go to Campbell University's camp, they're going to really like you because you're there. You've got to be careful about it, and that's where the honesty and communication, doing a bit of research and work with your coaches to find out what is the realistic goal here. And once you understand that, then pretty much all coaches have access to whatever nowadays, because it's the social network out there is you just make a call, and if you know somebody, it helps, but you can communicate with most people if their players have that ability.
Yep.
Right. So... that's kind of like the recruiting tactics for a lot of clubs. They'll say, like, well, we have connections at these 15 universities or these clubs or whatever it may be, and they use that as the recruiting. And I'm assuming you guys just promote based on building quality of players, or do you guys promote your club on other aspects then?
Well, we basically promote. I mean, we tell people, look, if you play with us, we're going to help you enjoy the game. We're going to develop a passion for the game. We're going to develop you, and you're going to compete at the highest level that you're capable of competing at. you know, and that's it. If that's something you want, great, you know. And you know, we help. We have a pathway to college. You know, initially we try to get our kids into high school to be able to play on one of the teams in high school. We're big supporters of high school. I think it's great. It gets them part of a social group in high school. And you know, and then the next is to try to develop them and get them opportunities in college. But that's also a little bit of an exclusive type of a process. You know, a lot of clubs, they say, well, you're only going to get seen by college coaches if you get accepted into the invitational college showcase tournaments. And some of that is true, but a lot of you know, if you want to get a scholarship to SMU, you pretty much need to be like somewhat of a national team player, right? Like, so a lot of these big colleges, high profile colleges, you kind of have to be, you know, pretty unique player, right? And so, and to get a scholarship. And a lot of times these Division I schools, like at SMU, I had a couple of players go there, they're getting partial scholarships. They're getting like 20%, you know, and that's it. And it's still going to be $30,000 a year to go there, you know, even with like a, I don't know what it is, but it's pretty hefty price tag. So there's a lot of things with college that go into picking the right school. So, you know, it's not just about soccer. And you know, I think that is kind of honestly a little bit of throws a wrench into a lot of things compared to in Europe, because you don't have that. You don't have the college aspect. When you're done playing U16, U17, you go into maybe the U21 team, or you join the first team. And when you enter your 30s or late or early 30s, you know, late 20s, early 30s, and you're kind of getting to the end of your career, you join the over 30 team, or you join the second team in the club. Like, you can stay in the same club and play all the way up until U60. I mean, and so here you don't have that. There's a lot of separation between the organizations, right? You got recreational soccer. Then after rec, you go play club soccer, right? And then you got high school soccer. It's totally separate. Then you got college. You get out of college, where do you go play? You play on some independent team in some local amateur league. You know, it's so disjointed, and nothing's together in a place where you can basically, and that's the way it's set up in Holland. I don't know if it's like that in England, Dennis, but
there's no college. There is some college ball, but it's kind of almost frowned upon. It's so different there.
Yeah.
But you know, over here you have ODP opportunities, regional team opportunities. If you get spotted by someone, we had some kids in our club off Wilco's team make the ODP program this past year, which was phenomenal. But the other side of that too, people sometimes forget. And one of the things I learned a lot about when my daughter was striving to go play in college over 7 years ago, it's we used to get bogged down with it. D1, I get into Division 1. And then you realize, you know, once she actually went to Campbell on a full scholarship, right? It ended up being the record goal scorer there still to this day in history. When I went to watch them play, I was so annoyed. I was like, is this Division 1? Is this Division 1? What is this? And there are so many levels of Division 1. And then you've got Division 2. And there are so many levels of Division 2, and then so many levels of Division 3. And they provide you, what I always try and say, if you love the game, if you really love the game, you can pick any level of school to go and play and get your education or some of your education paid for. Why wouldn't you do it? So if you're not a Division 1 level player, but you have an invite to go to a Division 3 school and they're willing to pay some of your school to offset those costs for your parents, and you love playing soccer anyway, let's go.
Yeah.
That again, right. that's the best thing again. That's brilliant. So sometimes people get carried away and go, oh, Division 1, and it's this. And again, it's a very small number that make it to that level. But what would happen if I was talking with people, it wouldn't just be about Division 1. I would say you need to keep your options open. You need to be sending letters to more than one school, one level of school. You should be sending them out to another 10 D2, D3. And then you need to plan your visits to these various schools and understand what is it you're trying to major in. Is that school really good for that? So we have the information. It just comes down to the reality of, like, what do you really want to do? And as long as they have options, and there are a lot of options in college, there are. And a lot of these clubs think, oh, if you play with us in the ECNL, that's the only college. That is not true. That is not the case.
Hey guys, I know this episode kind of just abruptly ends. We kind of ran out of time, and this was a two-part episode, and you guys will hear the next part with Dennis. But Wilco and Dennis were great in this episode. As we continue to dive down this road of club soccer and all these different clubs that are out there, I hope you start appreciating the small little things that each club has that makes them special. This is the end of part one with Dutch FC with Wilco and Dennis. Thank you, guys.